And tonight I want to talk about the Dharma of living and dying. And I wanted to just start by acknowledging that this is a challenging time for many, and that we're dealing with a lot of change, a lot of uncertainty. And I think many of us really appreciate how healing and important connection and community can be right now. And it's just such a refuge, you know, such an important part of this coming together and sharing the Dharma in this way. And so I wanted to start with a poem. And this is the poem from Stella Nasanovich. It can happen like that. Meeting at the market, buying tires amid the smell of rubber, the grating sound of jackhammers and drills. Anywhere we share stories and grace flows between us. The tire center waiting room becomes a healing place as one speaks of her husband's heart valve replacement, bed sores from complications. A man speaks of multiple surgeries, notes his false appearance as strong and healthy. I share my sister's death from breast cancer, her youngest, only 7. A woman rises, gives her name, then takes my hand. Suddenly, an ordinary day becomes holy ground. And so these true, authentic connections can mean so much. And in the face of suffering and loss, finding ways to share with compassion can be so powerful and healing. And, you know, the Buddha encouraged us to contemplate impermanence at all stages of our lives. And as part of our practice, part of engaging in life in a really deep and authentic way. And something happened to us recently at my Sangha here in Nashville. And we've had somebody who has been one of our core members for many years, and who was always there, you know, would show up 6:30 to help set up every week. You know, I could count on her being there whenever I would come in. Even if it wasn't her night to set up, she was there. And so I showed up, you know, this was in January. I showed up 6:30 one evening and nobody was there, and she wasn't there, and nobody seemed to be there to set up. And I thought, this is odd, because there's usually somebody there. And so I started doing it myself, you know, and then one of our other kind of key members showed up and we started setting up together. And I wondered, her name was Pam, and I wondered where she was. And then we meet at the Quaker House. And so one of the caretakers came in and let us know that Pam had had an accident and that she was in the hospital and had been severed her spinal column in the accident and was paralyzed from her shoulders down. And she went into cardiac arrest and only lived for another 6 days. And so it just happened like that. You know, this was a woman full of life, full of energy, a woman who gave an extraordinary amount to many, many communities. And just like that, she was gone. And many of you, you know, the longer we live, the more we experience losses. And yet the heart breaks, right? When I looked over those next weeks, there was a certain spot that she would sit and I would see the empty cushion. And it was like she was just gone. And the mystery of that, she was here one moment and gone the next. And, you know, it can be so shocking, even when we've been through this before and experienced loss, when there's this sudden change and this sudden shift. And, you know, my own experience, and I may have shared this with this group at another session, but what brought me to Buddhism was Buddha's teaching on impermanence. And I was 16, and my parents had already died. My mom died when I was 13, my dad when I was 16. And I was in a deep sense of confusion, and I had a Zen class that they gave in high school. They let us take a class, and there was a teaching from the Buddha on everything that has the nature to arise also has the nature to pass away. And when I heard those words, it was like everything shifted and my heart was at peace for just a moment, because in that moment, I realized that it wasn't personal. And I just rested for a moment in that teaching. And that put me on the path. I knew in that moment that the Dharma path would be the path that I would take in my life. And while this teaching wasn't, I had a long road ahead of me and I had a lot of grief to deal with, but yet that moment of peace was enough to help me to know that this was the path for me. And, you know, intentionally contemplating death as part of our practice can really help bridge the gap that we often may feel between the separation of life and death. And this contemplation really goes beyond maybe a conceptual orientation or an overthinking or the opposite of pushing away or aversion, but the deeper contemplation that can intentionally be done with awareness. And when I do that in my practice, I find that my concentration becomes deeper and more quickly, and petty irritants and concerns, desires and aversions fall away. And a sense of peace and even joy begins to arise out of the intentional contemplation. And I wanted to read this quote from Ken MacLeod. Some of you I know have heard of Ken MacLeod from the Tibetan tradition. Habituated patterns do not go easily. Resistance often arises as fear of the unknown. A gulf opens in front of us and we don't know what will happen if we step into it. Meeting the gulf is the essence of spiritual practice. It is why meditation on death is so important. To step into that unknowing is to die to the life we think we know and can control. To live awake means to face this dying in each moment. And so when I first started meditating, I was in the Zen tradition. And in the Zen tradition, they would have a phrase, to die on the cushion. And so each time we would come onto the cushion, the idea is we die to the self, we die to the clinging, we die to all of the things that are coming and going in our experience, and we allow it to fall away. And then something new is reborn. Something takes its place, something more open, more peaceful. And so that process of letting go of something, of releasing, is a kind of, it's a dying. And so it isn't a physical death, but it can be death of clinging and of separation. And I did a retreat one time, several years ago. I did a retreat up at Cloud Mountain. Some of y'all probably heard of Cloud Mountain up in Washington State. And I did a 7-day retreat there. And I chose to intentionally create a practice for the full week of contemplating the mystery of life and death for that full 7 days. And so all the sitting and walking, I would bring a question, a koan. You know, in Zen, there's the koan, the question that can't be answered through logical means. And so I would ask the question of life and death. And the fact that we come into this world and we see life is this that we have here, and death almost feels like it's a little bit separate. You know, it doesn't feel like it's in the moment with life. And yet the fact that we're born and the fact that we are going to die means that life and death are inherently always intertwined. And yet there's this separation or this sense of mystery. And so I just engaged in this mystery and this contemplation for the full week. And there wasn't a demand for an answer. There wasn't a demand for anything other than to ask this question, you know, what is the mystery? How do I engage this mystery? And by the end of the retreat, something had truly opened, and that division between life and death had completely erased itself. And there was this deep sense of connection of life and death in this moment. And my heart was completely open, and it's as if the veil had completely dropped away. And there was such a deep sense of peace in that moment. And at that time. And so it was just a really, really productive and useful contemplation and practice to do that. And it brought peace to my heart. And I want to read this again from Ken MacLeod. During my 7 years of retreat training, one of the genuine surprises was the extent to which the theme of impermanence and death permeated advanced meditation practice, particularly the direct awareness practices. Direct awareness is practiced by letting all expectations drop away so that we rest in total awareness, To let all expectations drop is to die to the moment. Therefore, meditation on death and impermanence plays a crucial role in preparing and sustaining awareness practice. Awareness of death and impermanence cuts through the veils of personal habituation and puts us in touch with life itself. And so when we do this intentional practice, it really brings us into a deeper sense of being alive more fully. And I'm sure many of you have heard of A Year to Live by Stephen Levine, and maybe some of you have done it before. And yes, I see that you have. And in 2019, I had my meditation group and I did this, and I've done it like three or four times over many years. But we did it in 2019, right before COVID. And there was such an interesting element of how we finished in January of 2020. And then a couple of months later, everything shut down. And there was like this complete change in how everybody lived. And there was this fear, you know, this fear of this disease that was killing people. And so many people said that that practice had helped them so much. And it was a group of people of all ages. We had people from 20s to somebody 92. I mean, everybody there was engaging in this deep practice and really found like a really profound opening. And it really helped them through COVID to have done this deep practice. And, you know, the Buddha, when he talked about contemplating death, he, you know, there's a story about how he asked the monks how they contemplated death. And they would talk about, you know, I think about just having one more meal, or I contemplate chewing one morsel of food, or I contemplate just taking a few breaths. And then finally, one monk said, just this one breath, I can do so much in just this one breath. And the Buddha said, yes, this is how you train yourself to dwell heedfully and mindfully in this very moment. And that is the ending of the affluence. This is how you should train yourself. And the affluence in Buddhism is painful thinking, narrative, unskillful ways of relating to life, tendencies that flow out of the mind, and fermentations of the mind that bubble up. And so he was saying this deep concentration on this very moment begins to end the affluence of suffering. And recently, you know, I was sending out, I have a couple of emails that I send out to my community. And in it, I put a link to Atisha's Contemplations. And I'm assuming some of you are familiar with Atisha's Contemplations, possibly. Okay, this was these are 9 contemplations of death from the 11th century Buddhist scholar. It's Atisha. The rest of the name I can't pronounce well, so I'll just stay with Atisha. But one thing I noticed was that of all the links in the 2 emails, nobody clicked more than on this link. There were a tremendous amount of clicks on this link. It's as if everybody wanted to know about these contemplations. And there was so much interest. And then people were saying, oh, you've got to do a retreat on death. You've got to do a retreat on death and dying. And so all these people have just, there's this interest. And so I wanted to share it with you. And it really, again, it's these contemplations are what bring us closer to life, even though many of us, like I said, the longer we live, the more we experience death, the closer it comes, both in terms of losing people we love and even our own lives. And yet still, we can bridge the gulf more intentionally in our practice, and it can bring us to a deeper sense of peace. So here are the contemplations. 1, death is inevitable. No one is exempt. Holding this thought, I abide in the breath. Our lifespan is ever decreasing. Each breath brings us closer to death. Holding this thought in mind, I delve deeply into this truth. 3, death will indeed come, whether or not we are prepared. Holding this thought in mind, I enter fully into the body of life. Human life expectancy is uncertain. Death can come at any time. Holding this thought in mind, I am attentive to each moment. 5, there are many causes of death. Even habits, desires, and accidents are precipitants. Holding this thought in mind, I consider endless possibilities. Number 6, the human body is fragile and vulnerable. Our life hangs by a breath. Holding this thought in mind, I attend to my inhale and exhale. Number 7, at the time of death, material resources are of no use to us. Holding this thought in mind, I invest wholeheartedly in practice. Number 8, our loved ones cannot keep us from death. There is no delaying its advent. Holding this thought in mind, I exercise non-grasping. And number 9, our body cannot help us at the time of death. It too will be lost at that moment. Holding this thought in mind, I learn to let go. And, you know, in looking at this, you know, there's a number of points at which breath comes into this contemplation. And something I think it's easy to overlook is the fact that our breath is our closest companion from birth to death. From that first in-breath until our last out-breath, it is the thing that we are closest to. It never goes away. This is our closest friend. And when we breathe and when we practice meditation and we bring breath to mind and heart, we're right there. We're connected to this, almost to this line, this moment of life and this one breath. And this one breath is just the step between living and dying. And at some point it goes away. And so to appreciate this breath, and as the Buddha said, just this one breath, this is all we need to do, is contemplate this one breath. And so I also want to speak about the pain of loss. And no matter how aware we are of death, when we lose a loved one, anyone we care about, it hurts, you know, and there's grief. And, you know, this is not a problem. It's a part of life. You know, when someone gets a diagnosis, you know, can be a shock, even deep grief, even when there's an expectation, knowing life is shorter and this is normal. And yet our heart, because of love and because of care, there is still that moment where it just feels it's hard to hold. And I don't see that's not a problem because, you know, that holding is love. And I've always been moved by this quote, this short quote from a wandering Zen poet called Isa. And this is what he wrote. He said, "This dewdrop world is a dewdrop world, and yet." And what he's saying is this life is just like a dewdrop, so impermanent, and yet. And what he was saying when he wrote this, he was speaking of the grief in his heart when he lost his son, his 6-year-old son. And yet, all is impermanent, and yet my heart loves and grieves. And so we can hold this. We can hold both the truth of impermanence, the fact that we all come and go, and yet our heart holds and touches love. And peace can come even in the midst of all of this. And we can meet this gulf of not knowing. And when we meet this gulf of not knowing, this is, as Ken MacLeod said, the essence of spiritual practice. And I remember hearing a talk from a hospice chaplain who helped people toward death of all spiritual backgrounds. And she said one of the things she noticed again and again is when somebody knew, when they realized that their death was coming soon, you know, when it was a definite thing and they were moving into hospice. And she said that that gulf opened, and for a moment people stepped into the not knowing. For a moment they let go of all of their religious beliefs, their spiritual beliefs, because so many religions, of course, want to try to answer the mystery of life and death. But in a moment they would let go of the scaffolding, and they would engage in the mystery. But then she said they would usually then recreate that scaffolding, would come back. It was just too hard. You know, if most people had not been trained in engaging in that gulf and in that mystery. And so they would move back into those, you know, whatever was kind of holding up. And I can understand that. It's not a criticism, but But just to say that that engaging in the Gulf is quite challenging. And so in grief and love, there's gratitude. And if life wasn't impermanent, where would the gratitude be? You know, it's like we don't care so much for plastic flowers that live forever, but we love live flowers because they don't live very long. We can appreciate their beauty because they're impermanent. They don't last. And I remember, and sometimes people worry on the Buddhist path too much about attachment, but, you know, as one somebody said, this was Jack Kornfield talking about this, and he knew a spiritual man in Africa who said, "You Americans don't know how to grieve." He said, "You don't give yourself enough time. You haven't learned to truly grieve." And when we were doing the Year to Live, there was one time, one of the exercises was that we were to bring in and to create an altar of all of the ancestors and the people in our lives who had died, and we were going to honor them. And so we all brought in photographs. And there was one person who didn't bring in a photo, and he said, "Well, I don't want to bring in a photo because that would mean attachment." And I felt like this was a sad misunderstanding of Buddhist teachings on attachment, because he felt he needed to keep his heart apart from or separate from the love that he felt for these people. And I want to say, for me, I'm grateful, you know, the woman who died, Pam, you know, I'm grateful for everything she brought, and that her absence also brought an awareness, a deep gratitude for her, but also I think our whole Sangha, we could really recognize the beauty of her being and all of the things that she brought to this world. And it was so interesting, and I know some of you have had this experience too, that when somebody dies and there's a service and everybody sharing, you know, a celebration of life, and everybody starts to share, there's so many qualities we may not have known about. There was so much more to this person than perhaps we had even seen. And with Pam, we were all shocked to find out that the number of communities that she was engaged in, and she was an activist and a social activist, and she did so much, and she never talked about it, and she gave so much. She lived a profound life of service, and she was so humble, she never talked about it. And it was only in her death that we saw the depth of her being and the beauty of her being and how much she gave to this world. And so the depth of the gratitude just deepened so much, and the sense of her being became so tangible and so real. And so that gratitude came forth in the whole essence of her being. And I think that can happen so often. So many facets of a person we might hold in our head, but then as we get to see that person through the depth of all of the hearts that knew that being, we can touch so deeply into something that goes beyond just what we think or think we know, and move into deep gratitude. And so I want to share this poem from Mary Oliver, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with it. Probably it's called "When Death Comes." When death comes like the hungry bear in autumn. When death comes and takes all the bright coins from his purse to buy me, and snaps the purse shut. When death comes like the measles pox. When death comes like an iceberg between the shoulder blades. I want to step through the door full of curiosity, wondering, what is it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? And therefore, I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood. And I look upon time as no more than an idea. And I consider eternity as another possibility. And I think of each life as a flower, as common as a daisy in a field, and as singular. And each name a comfortable music in the mouth, tending as all music does towards silence. And each body a lion of courage and something precious to the earth. When it's over, I want to say, all my life, I was a bride, married to amazement, and I was the bridegroom, taking the world into my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I had made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world. So, this one always touches me. And so we have some time, and I always like to open it up for sharing, contemplation, questions. So happy to open it up for a little conversation. Yes, Veda, is that correct?
Please, those 9 or 10 contemplations, they came from Atisha, is that correct name? Could
yes.
you spell that? And how do we get that information?
Yeah, it's A-T-I-S-H-A and Atisha.
S-H, I'm sorry, A-T-I-S-H-A. I got it. Uh-huh.
Atisha's Contemplations. And if you Google that, it'll come up really quickly. And I can still sell it in the chat.
No, I put it in the chat so you can ignore it.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Beautiful talk.
Thank you. Okay, is it, let's see, who raised their hand? Okay, Marin.
Right. This is Bill, sorry.
All right.
The Mary Oliver poem always reminds me of Tallulah Bankhead's statement that she said, "When I die, I don't want to be saved. I want to be spent."
Beautiful. Okay, Patty?
Thank you. That was beautiful, Lisa. When you were reading those contemplations, you seemed to skip a few numbers.
I did. I know.
And I don't know if you read them without the numbers or you just skipped them, but I would love to know if we missed anything because that was really beautiful.
Thank you. Yes, and I did. I simply skipped a few numbers, and then I realized that I put, so yes, I read them all, but a few I didn't give the numbers to. So if you look it up, you'll find all of the, you will be able to find the full, but I didn't miss anything. I just didn't give them all the numbers. So
thank you. I appreciate the clarification.
Yeah, you're welcome. Jan.
Yeah, I did a quick look up and I found Joan Halifax's explanation of all 9. Quite a lengthy thing. And yes, you did all 9. I wanted to say this is one of the more profound talks I've ever heard. Thank you very much. I work with hospice on a weekly basis. And, you know, it's something that I think I've handled. And then a talk like this comes along and I realize I may not have. That there's more work to do, but I like your equation of grief and love and gratitude. I think that's a pretty powerful stuff. Thank you.
Let's see, we have Mary and Bowman. I think, Mary, were you? Yeah.
Yes, thank you very much for this talk. I have a group of, we met at a program on Spirit Rock years ago. And we still meet once a month. And the last things we talked about was the 5 heavenly messengers. And I was looking at them. And because I'm older, this is something, yes. And it's interesting because I have conversations with people that are even older than I am that don't, that they, and you just, I think a lot of the difficulties in this world are the fact that people live their life as if they're going to die.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought, you know, if that was something you could kind of like have it like sitting on your shoulder or sitting with you. And it was interesting because I have a brother who's 2 years older than I am, and he had surgery, and he doesn't talk that much, but it was really interesting because we actually had a conversation where that was something that we touched on. And I have to say, a lot about getting older really sucks, excuse me. But one of the things that's good is the fact that there's a realization about how precious each moment is. So I really appreciate your talk. It's like, really, it is. And it's like, I think about, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, but I know that probably in 10 years, I am not going to be here. It's a really good possibility. And so what do I want to be doing with the time that I have? And it's not something that makes me sad necessarily. It's something that makes me grateful, the fact that I actually got to live this long and I have this time. And I think that I think one of the things is it makes it easier too for the losses that one has in their life. You don't get to be my age and not have had people that you love die. And for me, there's a very, very deep sadness, but it's the gratitude that these people were actually in my life is larger. And so that to me is so profound. And I really like the fact that love and death are hand in hand. They are hand in hand. So thank you so much for this lovely talk. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. So Bowman.
Hey, Lisa, first of all, I just want to say I'm really, really sorry for the loss of Pam. I read some things on your really heartfelt, deep sympathy. And also, you know, you were instrumental in my dealing with the loss of my son and my mom and holding that grief. And I remember coming to you and saying, like, how do you let this go? What do you mean let it go? What are you supposed to do with it? And you had said to me that, you know, you shared your experience about losing your grandmother. And you said, well, what if it was just a permanent part of you? And just allowed it to be there. And, you know, that really opened the door to me to begin to heal. Because I kept trying to push it away and get rid of it and get over it and not be with it. And, you know, just the importance of being able to do that was so freeing. And I also just wanted to say about what you said about healing encounters. And they have been so beautiful in my life. I lost my mom and my son and my brother-in-law, all three to suicide. And so I got a tattoo. A semicolon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is the international sign for suicide prevention. And I can't tell you how many times I've been in a waiting room or online at the grocery store, and someone will say, what does that mean? And it opens a conversation that is so meaningful and so healing. There's never been a person that hasn't said, oh, my mother, oh, my friend, oh, my neighbor, oh, my cousin. And, you know, it really opens the door. And I remember one day in particular, there was a young girl at the cash register at the grocery store, and she just had her head down and she was just focused on what she was doing. And I noticed she had a semicolon, and I kept trying to get her, you know, to look up and like, hello, you know, and finally she did. And I went like this, and we both just shed a tear and touched wrists, and it was beautiful. It was really beautiful. So I just wanted to really say, thank you for this talk and thank you for opening the door for me.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you for sharing about these encounters, you know, with your, this, and it makes me think of the little poem I read at the beginning where people, it's like holy ground when we share our hearts, you know, we share these deep losses and we can, it's just such a beautiful connecting point, you know, to be able to share our sorrow together. Something healing about that. Thank you so much for that, sharing that. Yeah.
Could you tell us the name of the poet again for that poem that you read about the healing ground?
The very beginning?
Yeah.
Yeah, let me go back to my note here. It is Stella. I'm going to put this in the chat for you guys. I'm just going to copy it and paste it in there. Because it's kind of another one of those weird, you know, so you can find it. Yeah, there you go. So there's her name.
Okay, I'll relay that to group as a whole.
Oh, it didn't go to the whole group. Did I just put it to
It just went to me. Yeah, I can't cut and paste from it. So if you just
I thought I had done that. Okay.
I also want to mention that Vita, who's going to handle the meta, her computer died. So if you want to send meta wishes, you could probably send it again. I know that he sent it to Bill in chat, Marin Sangha, and he will be the one to take care of it if that's okay with you, Bill, since you're a co-host. I know that will work. Thanks.
Oh, and I did put it to everyone. I thought Marin Sangha meant the whole Sangha. That's
no, what I should have changed my name. I usually do.
Okay.
I just forgot.
So I've got it. I think y'all should see it now. Yeah.
Yes, it went to everyone.
And so I did want to share something that I was driving home from teaching a retreat a couple of years ago, and there was on NPR, there was a segment called The Hidden Brain. And it was just fascinating because there was this person who, this scientist who has worked on he studied the way humans' relationship to death and how it drives people in their motivation in unconscious ways all through life. And it's absolutely fascinating. And I wish I had the name in front of me, but there was, it's on The Hidden Brain. And it was like something about how death motivates our actions in life and not necessarily in good ways, but it was really a fascinating story. If I do think of it or find it, I'll send it to Mary in case you ever get a chance to share it with everybody else. But it was just absolutely fascinating. So any other questions?
Was it Shankar Vedantan?
No, what's that?
The Hidden Brain.
Uh-huh.
Shankar Vedantan?
Is that a name? I can't quite hear the name you're mentioning. Is it a person's name?
Yeah.
Oh,
it's a hard one.
Oh, okay. Could be. Or does it sound familiar? Might be familiar to you.
He's the host of that program. This is Deborah.
Okay,
he's the host of that program.
Okay.
And thank you. That was beautiful. And again, condolences for the loss of your Sangha member, your friend, and that wonderful woman. And thank you for being here and sharing all of that beautiful stuff with us.
You're welcome. Thank you. And I see Liz has...
Hi, I just finished A Year to Live through Spirit Rock, and there's also one going on at Insight LA, and I think one at Insight New York, so it's all over the place.
Yes.
And I would really, really recommend it, because as an 85-year-old about to be 86, somehow there's a lot of shame about being old and being close to death, which is utterly ridiculous, but it normalized it for me really beautifully, and it was just a lovely experience. Our sharing group is going on and meeting, but I want to recommend A Year to Live for those who want to do it.
Thanks. Thanks, Liz. Okay. Okay, we have one Angel. I think we have time for one more question. Is it Angel?
Hi, yes, Angel. Thank you for that, Lisa. I lived in Murfreesboro, Tennessee for a while. So it's a little bit of flashback for me. I guess for me, yeah, I'm just sitting here listening to everyone, and I'm in my 40s now. Just am very aware sometimes of the delusion that I'm under, that I'm not going to die, that I've had my whole life. I mean, I feel like it's been a conscious thought for me at times too, like from childhood, like I'm not going to die. No, everyone else is. I'm not going to die. And now I operate on that in such an interesting way. And I wonder if it's cultural, if there are other parts of the world that maybe synthesize death differently, that live with it in a different way. Because certainly we have this binary idea around it, that it's separate, you know, and that it's a phase, or that it's an end point. And just to hear it talked about, like, as soon as we're born, we're dying, and so I wonder, you know, and it's just such a big idea when I become conscious of the delusion that I'm under, that it's not going to happen to me. Like, I'm going to die, you know, and it's terrifying in some ways for me. And I wonder if that's from our, whether it's cultural or whatever, just our compartmentalization of it as a society. I don't know, like, that it's so strong when the reality of it comes back. But I don't know. I'm just kind of struck with the idea of death right now, like that I am this delusion that I'm under, that it's like not going to happen to me. And, I wonder what it would look like to live with it a little more closely, or sometimes I feel it in my bones, you know, but it's like you're saying, not a conscious thing necessarily a lot of the time. And I wonder, but it's our existence though, you know, it's like, it's what we're doing here. Like, it's not permanent. And so it's pretty profound to like live life that way, knowing that it's going to happen. So thank you, everyone.
Well, and thank you for your comments. And I'll just briefly say, because I know we're about out of time, but I'll just say, I really did think that we have created a further and deeper binary by separating life and death. Older cultures, people lived, they shared homes, people died in the house, people honored death. You go to India and you see people burning bodies, you know, on the Ganges. It's right out in front of your face. And I didn't, my husband and I went to a Native American ruins one time, and one of the Native American guides said, people always ask us, are you lonely because you've lost so many of your ancestors? And they said, but the ancestors are not gone. They're right here with us. They truly felt the presence of their ancestors. They did not see the binary in the same way that many of us do. They held it in their hearts. And it was kind of a beautiful thing. So I do believe that our culture in particular has created a deep binary that has made it harder. And that's why we have to work harder to be more closer to it in a more heartfelt way, I think. So thanks. All right.